Today we're going to discuss the two primary heroes of the story of Megillat Esther, Mordechai and Esther. We're going to compare and contrast them. Let's begin with Mordechai. Mordechai's name is connected to Marduk, the Babylonian god. The Das Mikra explains that Jews who were exiled to Babel had non-Jewish names, similar to today. Many of us have English names, not just Hebrew names. Now, from which tribe was Mordechai? In Perek Bey's Pasuk Hey, the Megillah says, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan Amirosh, but Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yemini. He was a Yehudi and he was a Yemini. So Yehudi sounds like he was from Yehuda. Yemini sounds like he was from Binyamin. Well, Rashi explains that he's an Ish Yehudi. Why is he called Yehudi? Because he was exiled with Malcha Yehuda, with Golus Yehuda. So anyone who was exiled with the southern kingdom, right? The tribes were split into the northern kingdom, Malcha Yisrael, the southern kingdom, Malcha Yehuda. So Yehuda was exiled, or his ancestors were exiled with Shevet Yehuda, with Malcha Yehuda. So he's called a Yehudi. Why is he called Ishimini? Because he was from Shevet Binyamin. The Gemara Megillah Daf Gimel Aleph explains that he was from Shevet Binyamin. Why is he called Yehudi? Al shum shekafar b'avodah zarah. He was someone who rejected idolatry. Shekol kofar b'avodah zarah nikra Yehudi. Anyone who rejects avodah zarah is called a Yehudi. The Marsha explains that the name Yehudi or Yehudi has all the letters of Shem Havaya, of God's name, Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey. So that's the connection between Mordechai and being Yehudi. Either he was someone who was a proud Jew, or he was from Shevet Yehuda. What was the relationship between Mordechai and Shaul? So he's called Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ishimini. So the Das Mikra explains that Shimi and Kish may have been ancestors, not necessarily grandfather and great-grandfather. Shimi ben Gera was from the family of the house of Shaul, and Kish was the father of Shaul. Now, Ibn Ezra points out that if Kish was really referring to Shaul's father, then the Megillah should have also mentioned Shaul, because he was a chush of important person. It should have said Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Shaul, Ben Kish. But so he's not sure whether Mordechai descended from Shaul. However, in the Megillah Esther seems to connect the battle of the Jews against Amalek. It seems that Mordechai is related to Shaul. Haman's called Ha'agagi, which referencing the king whom Shaul kept alive and who, according to Chazal, fathered a child from whom Haman descended. The Das Mikra also points out that in both the battle against Amalek and against the enemies in the story of Purim, the Jews did not take any spoils, and the requirement to write the story in a sefer is similar to the requirement that we're supposed to write what Amalek did to us in the Torah. So there are a lot of similarities between this story and the war between Amalek and the Jewish people. Now, what's Mordechai's relationship with Esther? The Das Mikra explains they were cousins, or they were close relatives. It says that according to Megillah, Perek Beis Pasuk Zayin, it said that he was a bas dodo, which is a cousin, or it could simply mean that they were close relatives. Mordechai takes care of her after her parents pass away. However, Rashi, based on the Gemara, based on an opinion in the Gemara, believes that they were married, which compounds the problem of her living with Ahasuerus. Now, Mordechai commands Esther not to disclose her identity. The Ibn Ezra explains that some people say that Mordechai did not act properly in commanding Esther not to disclose her identity because he was afraid that the king would not take her as a wife if it was known that she was from the exile. According to the Ibn Ezra, cites some who say that Mordechai wanted Esther to win the pageant, the beauty contest, the who's going to be the queen. And therefore, Mordechai told her not to disclose her identity because that would disqualify her. Whereas he says others say that he had a prophecy or a dream. He knew that salvation would come through her, so therefore he told her not to disclose her identity. However, the Ibn Ezra believes, this is in Perek Beis Pasuk Tes, in his commentary, he says that Mordechai did this because he wanted her to have the ability to observe Torah and mitzvot. What does that mean? That if she wanted to keep Shabbos and she didn't want to not eat, and he wanted her to only eat kosher food. So if she would tell the king that she, or disclose to other people that she was a Jew, then they would force her, they would mock her and force her to eat non-kosher. They would force her to violate Shabbos. So that's the reason why. Rashi simply says that initially Mordechai told her not to tell her ancestry because she descended from a king. She descended from Shaul HaMelech. And if she would disclose her identity, that would increase her chances of being selected as the queen. And Mordechai did not want her to be selected as the queen. Now, that, by the way, seems to be the simple reading of the text, seems to be that she, the Pasuk says, Vatilakach, that she was taken, meaning that she did not want to participate in this beauty contest to become the queen, and she was taken forcibly. Rashi's explanation can explain why initially she doesn't disclose her identity. But after she's selected to be the queen, why does she then not disclose her identity? Maybe it looks bad why she didn't do so beforehand. Maybe Mordechai knew that salvation would come from her. It was meant to be, and therefore, just as she didn't disclose her identity originally, she must continue not to do so. Now, Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman. Now, that's a difficult thing for Mordechai to do. The question is, why doesn't Mordechai bow down to Haman? And why does Mordechai put himself in a situation where he endangers all the Jews simply because he doesn't bow down to Haman? Now, Chazal tell us in Esther Rabbah, the medicine Esther Rabbah, points out that Haman also lo tzelem merukam al begadav, that Haman affixed an idol to his heart. So bowing to Haman would be to bow to idolatry, which is avodah zarah. Rashi points out that Haman was asa atzma aloha. He made himself into a god. That's why Mordechai does not bow down to him. And this approach could be related to the comment by the Das Mikra, who writes that we find very often that Gedolei Yisrael would be mishtachaveh. They would bow before non-Jewish rulers. But to be korea umishtachaveh, that lashon lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh, that's something we only find by God. And this, Mordechai believed, was avak avodah zarah. It was like idolatry. And because of this, Mordechai was willing to put the entire nation in danger. Which is a little difficult, because why, for example, why does Mordechai pass Haman every day? Why, if Mordechai doesn't want to bow down to Haman because he has an idol fixed him, why didn't Mordechai take a different street to go to work? Why does he specifically pass by Haman each and every day and not bow down to him? Now, the Ibn Ezra explains that he would have liked to, but the Ibn Ezra in Perek Gimel Pasuk Daled says that lo yuchal asur mishar hamelach, kim yasur below mitzvah hamelach, damo berosho. He would have wanted to leave, but he wasn't permitted to leave the Shar HaMelech, the gate of the king. This was Mordechai had to pass by each and every day. He had to pass by Haman each and every day. He had no choice. However, maybe we can also argue that Mordechai sees his brethren bowing down to Haman, and he must take a stand, even if he's putting his life and the life of the nation in danger. But Mordechai recognizes there's another danger. Mordechai recognized that this was not merely a physical struggle between Haman and Mordechai, a game of chicken between the two, if you will, but it was an ideological struggle. Once Haman affixes that idol of himself on the breast of his heart so that everyone, including the Jews, would bow down to him, Mordechai saw that Haman came in the name of religion. Haman wanted everyone to worship him as a god, so Mordechai could not bow down to him. He had to stand up for his nation. What does that mean, though? It means that everyone else rationalized to bow down to Haman, saying they're just bowing out of respect to the viceroy. They're not bowing down to an idol, so Mordechai must act. Yes, Mordechai, the fully Persian Jew with a non-Jewish name who seems to have assimilated completely into Persian society, Mordechai is an Ish Yehudi. Why is it called an Ish Yehudi? Because he denounces idolatry. Only Mordechai did not bow to Haman. This conflict looked like a physical power struggle between Mordechai and Haman, but Chazal saw it as an ideological struggle as well, as Mordechai is the spiritual descendant of Shaul, and Haman is the spiritual descendant of Agag. This is not simply a political struggle, but an ideological struggle between the Yehudi and the Amalekite. had the Bnei Yisrael all bow down to Haman, that was okay to Haman, because bowing down meant assimilating into Persian society and disappearing into Persian society. It means, as the Gemara in Megillah tells us, celebrating at Achashverosh's big party and endorsing his worldview that the Jews will not return to Eretz Yisrael, that the dream of another Beis HaMikdash is dead, that Persia should become one large melting pot. But Mordechai refuses. He refuses to attend the party, and he refuses to bow to Haman. This man is trying to create a spiritual holocaust, not through force, but through deception. And of course, once this fails, he must try a different plan to destroy the Jews. He hates the Jew and Judaism. Now, the truth is, one can argue that Mordechai was not fully aware of the consequences of his actions. He thought that he might be putting his life on the line, but he couldn't imagine that anyone in their right mind would wipe out an entire nation because of a single person's actions. That perhaps can explain why in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Aleph, when Mordechai finds out what happened, Vayikra Mordechai Spigadav, Mordechai rips his garments, Vayilbash Sak Va'efer, he wears sackcloth and ashes, because he is totally devastated when he discovers everything that occurred and that happened because of him. He couldn't even in his wildest dreams imagine, because he wouldn't bow down to Haman, all of a sudden the fate of all the Jewish people is in danger. Last question about Mordechai. Mordechai has this plan for Esther. What does he say? He tells her, I want you to go to the king right now and tell him about the plan and that Haman's trying to wipe out your nation and try to convince the king to stop the plan. Now, what's fascinating is that Esther, again, he's convinced Esther to put her life on the line to meet with Achashverosh. I'm wondering, why doesn't she wait until he summons her? After all, the killings of the Jews aren't scheduled to take place for another year. She meets Achashverosh on Pesach, and the plan to kill the Jews is not for another 11 months. I'm sure Esther will be summoned at some point, but coming to the king unannounced, she may put her life in jeopardy, and then certainly there will be no Jew in the palace to save the Jews. What's the rush? I think the truth is that perhaps this is Esther's claim to Mordechai when he asks her to go to the king. She tells him, I haven't been called in 30 days. And according to the Megillat Starim, she asks Mordechai, isn't it better to wait until she's summoned to the king? And the answer says, Mordechai is no. Risk your life now. But why? Why the rush? It seems that Esther has a legitimate claim. Why the rush? So the answer is, after the decree to kill the Jews is put into place, Mordechai tries to convince Esther to come to the king now. When Esther hesitates, she says, isn't it better that I wait until he calls me? It's been 30 days. He's bound to call me soon. And what does Mordechai respond? He says, Mi yodea, im leis kazos igat lamachus. Mordechai is telling her, says the Ibn Ezra, maybe you only became queen for this particular purpose, so that you should save the Jewish people. See, ever since Esther became queen, Mordechai was asking himself, why? Why? Why did she become queen? Mordechai was searching for a sign. There must be a reason. There must be a reason why, of all of the women chosen, Esther was chosen. Finally, 5 years later, Mordechai saw the sign. This is the reason why Esther was selected to become the queen, to save the Jews. Once Mordechai found the sign, he truly believed that everything would turn out okay, and he forced the issue with Esther to go to the king immediately, perhaps so that the decree could be overturned before copies of the decree were sent out throughout all the lands. But once Mordechai saw the sign, he had faith, and that faith strengthened him to act swiftly and decisively. We can view Mordechai's behavior as being an example not of extreme bitachon, but of hishtadlut par excellence. When Esther tells Achashverosh that she can't go meet the king because she needs to be summoned by the king, and she hasn't been summoned for 30 days, Mordechai tells her, Mi yodem leiz kazosi gat lamalchus. Rashi explains, who knows if over time you'll be in the same position of power that you are now. Because what's been happening recently? Achashverosh's life has been threatened by Big Son and Teresh. So Achashverosh appoints Haman as his deputy and orders that everyone should bow down to him. We have not seen anyone else have this much power who is not the king. Then when Haman asks to kill the Jews, Achashverosh not only grants the request, but he gives the ring to Haman. Haman slowly is becoming the real power behind the throne. And meanwhile, Achashverosh is becoming more and more isolated. Esther beforehand presumably was permitted to go to the king without permission when she told him of the plot against her life. But now nobody could come see the king without permission. Haman is becoming more and more the face of the kingdom, and Achashverosh is slowly becoming more and more of a figurehead. Mordechai realizes this, so he tells Esther, Mi Yodea, who knows if the king won't get rid of you soon like he did to Vashti? Who knows if soon Haman will have so much power that you'll be unable to convince the king to kill Haman? Maybe Haman will discover Esther's true identity. Time is of the essence, according to Mordechai, even though 11 months are left until the decree against the Jews is to be carried out, and even though Esther is potentially putting her life at risk by coming to the king unannounced. In the Sefer Yosef Lekach Esther, the 16th century rabbi of Elazar Ashkenazi explains that going without an appointment to see the king would have a greater impact. According to the Malbim, the king never intended the decree, but coming to his throne room unannounced should apply to Esther. And Mordechai probably believed that to be the case. So he has Esther come in unannounced to create a sense of urgency that she is willing to put her life on the line. The issue that Esther is about to raise is very important. The king has many meetings with many people with a lot of ideas. So if Esther would have a meeting with the king, he might not take her request that seriously. However, now he is startled and he offers her up to half the kingdom. He knows that Esther has something urgent to tell him. And the lesson for us is one of extreme hishtadlut. At times, it's not easy to make hishtadlut, to put forth your best efforts, because it will cause angst and discomfort. You can say, God will take care of it, but if we truly think about what's right, we know that we have to do. We have to act. Mordechai teaches us extreme hishtadlut. Even if inaction on the surface seems like the safer course, there are times in our life that we must take the more difficult road, which likely will ultimately be more rewarding. So let's talk a bit about Esther and then compare the two. Esther, what's her name? Is it Esther? Is it Hadassah? Megillah says it's both. Esther is probably her foreign name, probably connected to the Babylonian goddess Ishtar. And her Jewish name is Hadassah, and the Gemara has a whole host of reasons as to why she is called Esther. Now, Esther has this plan with Haman. When she invites the king to a party with Haman, she doesn't invite him to one party, she invites him to a party twice, two feasts. The question is, why not simply send word to the king and meet him and tell him what Haman is planning? Why invite them both to one feast and then a second feast? Apparently, the rule was that even the wife couldn't send the message to the king. She was just an object, and she had to be invited by the king to speak to him. So therefore, she needs to be cunning. Apparently, Esther had much less standing to advise the king than did Haman. She also understood that the king wouldn't necessarily do what's right and good. He is only interested in personal considerations. I think there are two ways to understand Esther's behavior. The first approach is that Rashi understood Esther's plan is that Esther wanted to make the king suspicious. Why is she inviting Haman to the party? Haman is very powerful, and we know that there was already an attempt on the king's life, which likely prompted the law that any unauthorized entry into his inner courtyard would result in death. According to Rashi, Esther is playing on the king's sense of insecurity, and she wants to create some distance between the king and Haman before she discloses her identity. If Esther would immediately tell the king that Haman had plotted against her, then it's likely that the king would choose Haman over Esther. After all, the king had killed his queen beforehand, and Haman was his most trusted servant. According to Chazal, Haman was Memuchan, and now Haman is clearly his most trusted servant. Therefore, it was imperative that before Esther spring the news, she would create some mistrust between the king and Haman. And that's why Esther creates jealousy and intrigue in the palace of the king. She invites the king and Haman to two parties. Why invite Haman? This must raise suspicions about the loyalty of Haman. And the truth is, even after Haman is killed, Esther still must beg the king to spare the Jews. In fact, Rashi's position seems to go hand in hand with the position of Yeshua ben Karcha in Maseches Megillah. She thought that the king would believe that Esther and Haman were conspiring against the king, and so the king would kill both of them, in which case she believed that the decree would be canceled. Also, by the second party, Esther is the equal. Because in the first party, the Pasuk says in Perek Vav, Pasuk Hey, Perek Hey Pasuk Dalid says that the king, the Melech and Haman, the king and Haman came, Ela Mishter saw Esther. The king and Haman came to the party that Esther made. So they were equals, and Esther was like the waitress. But the second party, in Perek Zayin Pasuk Aleph, the pasuk says Vayova Melch v'Haman lishtoti Esther Malka, that the king and Haman come to drink together with Esther. She's no longer a waitress, but they drink together. There's greater comfort. Additionally, with Haman present, she can catch him off guard, so he would not have time to think of a plan to counteract Esther's plea. A second approach to understand Esther's plans is that even Ezra believed that she was planning to tell the king at the first party, but she was waiting for a sign from God that God had heard her prayers and that God had seen the fast of the people of Shushan. It is true the king did not kill her when she approached him unannounced, but she needed a stronger sign that God was on her side. Because what happened between the first and second parties? Haman was forced to lead Mordechai through the streets. Now she believed that Haman ultimately was going to fail, and now she was ready to tell the king who she was at the second party. She saw this sign of God. Therefore, according to Ibn Ezra, like Mordechai, Esther searched for a sign, found her sign, and was strengthened by that sign, and had the courage and faith to plead with the king at the second party that resulted in the downfall of Haman and the salvation of the Jews. And that is what the Megillah is all about. It's a story of a world seemingly without any signs, where God seemed to be absent. We don't find the name of God anywhere in the Megillah, but in fact, it tells a story of a hero and a heroine who both at different times search for a sign, find a sign, and they are strengthened by that sign. Now, there's a big problem, halakhic problem, about Esther. She has relations with a non-Jewish king, and it's very problematic, especially according to the position in the Gemara that she was married to Mordechai. Abaye in the Gemara says, Masechet Sanhedrin said, she was a passive participant, so it wasn't forbidden. Rava says that Achashverosh did it for his own benefit, so that she should abandon her religion. That's why it's okay. But there's a more problematic position that Esther takes. That when Esther decides to go to the king, according to the Gemara, she basically says that I'm now going to try to seduce the king. Until now, he forced himself upon me to be intimate with me. And now I'm going to go willingly. And if I get lost, I get lost. What does that mean? According to the Gemara, that before I was taken away from, my father's house, and I'm going to be forbidden to you, Mordechai, because I'm now willingly giving myself to the king. How can she do this? So the Ma'arik has an interesting opinion. Now, a little background first. Yom HaKippurim is Kippurim, right? With the Zohar, which says Yom Kippur is like Purim. So what does that mean, that the Yom Kippur is Yom Kippurim is Kippurim? So the Zohar cites the verse from Esther. When he makes that comment, he cites the verse from Esther, Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph, where it says, "V'hi b'yom ha'shlishi v'atilbash Esther malchus," that Esther is wearing clothing, a royal clothing. "V'tamru chatzar beis ha'melech ha'pnimis," she stands by the courtyard of the king, the inner kingdom of the house of the king, the inner house. "Nochach beis ha'melech," by the house of the king. "V'melech yoshev v'kiseh malchus," and the king is sitting on his throne, the beis ha'melechus, in his royal palace. And Nochach Pesach Bayis, by the opening of the house. So it is specifically on these words, this pasuk, that Zohar makes the comparison between Yom Kippur and Purim. The Zohar is telling us, lest you think that Esther is entering the inner chamber to conduct herself in a sordid manner. Esther is putting on a royal garb, it's just like the Kohen Gadol dressing in the priestly garments. Esther enters into the inner chamber like the Kohen Gadol. In this way, Purim is like Yom HaKippurim, when the Kohen Gadol is clothed in beautiful clothing, similar to Esther putting on the royal clothing. And Esther found favor in the eyes of the king, just as the Kohen Gadol found favor in the eyes of God, and immediately God heard and God forgave. What does this mean, that Esther was like the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur coming to visit the king? What is the Zohar trying to teach us about Esther? Esther is taken by force to take part in a beauty pageant to determine who's to be the queen, but there's no ordinary beauty pageant. According to the Megillah, each contestant is to spend the night with the king and then remain in the palace, but one woman is to be chosen as the queen. So Esther is forced to have relations with the king, is chosen as the queen, and continues to be forced to have relations with the king. And there are halakhic discussions. How can you do this? Don't you have to give up your life for this? And it seems that if she is essentially engaged in activity by force and is passive, then she doesn't have to give up her life. But what she does, when she finds out about the fate of her people, she decides to take action. She will approach the king unannounced. She says, "Uvachein avo el ha-melech asher lo kadas." She's going to come to the king lo kadas. On one level, it means that she will be coming to the king without being summoned. However, the Midrash, I just mentioned before, the Gemara understand that something else is at play here. She is now changing her tune towards the king. Now she will have Bia with the king willingly. She'll try to perhaps seduce the king, to try to save her people by being intimate with the king. V'chasher avadati avadati, as I mentioned, that now I'm going to be lost to Mordechai. Esther's willing to give up any future with the Jewish people because she agrees to willingly submit herself to the king in order to save her people. But the Midrash Lekach Tov goes one step further. And he says that the V'chasher Avadati, just I'm lost from you, Avadati Gam Ani Nafshi, my soul will be lost. I will give up my portion in the world to come. Esther agrees to commit an Avera sin, but one of the three big ones, sleeping with a non-Jew. And if she was married to Mordechai at the time, oh my gosh, it's also adultery. And the question is, why does she do that? Vashti, for example, refused to come to Achashverosh. She picked death over Achashverosh. So Esther has a choice. And Esther chose to sin with Achashverosh rather than die. So how can she do this? So Rav Yosef and Shlomo Kolon, the Marik, explains that this was an Aver Lishma. She committed a sin for the sake of heaven. It was justified because it led to the salvation of the nation. So the Marik argues that it is true that an individual may not transgress the biblical prohibition of adultery. But Esther's situation, to save all of Klal Yisrael, she can commit the sin of being with Achashverosh, and this is an Avera Lishma. Saving Klal Yisrael supersedes the halachic prohibition of being intimate with Achashverosh, according to the Maharik. Again, the Netziv in a Tshuva writes that two conditions must be satisfied for engaging in an Avera Lishma. First, the individual committing the sin must sin with the purest of intentions, not to derive benefit from the sin at all. And the careful calculation must be made that the advantages of the sin outweigh the disadvantages. And obviously, this cannot be taken lightly. But the upshot of this approach is that the self-sacrifice for the sake of the Jewish people is not limited to physical sacrifice. The sacrifice in spiritual integrity and eternal reward is also, sacrifice of spiritual integrity and eternal reward is also heroic. And that's how Rav Tzadok of Lublin understands this Zohar. Esther enters into the Kodesh Kedoshim of the king, motivated solely by love for her people and the desire to save them. She enters just like the Kohen Gadol, and her deeds might cost her the world to come, the Olam Haba, just as Aaron's sin in the episode of the golden calf might have cost him the world to come. After all, one reasonable way of understanding the story of the golden calf is Aaron willingly built the calf because he realized that if he would stand in their way, the people would kill him, just as they killed Chor. Then they would be leaderless. Better that Aaron sin and build the calf and be punished for it and save the people from even greater destruction. And in both cases, Hashem accepted their sacrifice, understood their total devotion, spared the Jewish people because of their sacrifice, and elevated them to a new status. Aaron becomes the Kohen Gadol, and Esther becomes just like Aaron, the Kohen Gadol that day. Yom Kippurim Kippurim, Aaron like Esther. One can only imagine the struggle of an Aaron and of an Esther in trying to come to terms with the fact they would have to give up their own personal spiritual integrity for the sake of the nation and wondering if they're doing the right thing. And this is very rare, obviously, but to happen for the Jewish people, but it's the heroism of Esther, her sacrifice for the sake of Klal Yisrael that serves as a powerful motivator for us to try to sacrifice more for our people. Mordechai then represents the straight man who's not afraid to take a stand. He was perhaps the only Jew in the Persian court. Mefarshim say that after Haman was killed, Mordechai was next in line to be the advisor because he was the wealthiest after Haman. Yet he does not participate in the prohibited feasts. He's very straight and he will risk everything and take action to stand with God, to stand with the Jewish people. Esther represents the cunning person who transforms herself into a heroine when she was inspired by Mordechai and she is able to beat Haman at his own game, perhaps using a bold halachic position. Hakol kol Yaakov v'yadayim yidei Esav. We need both the straight and the cunning to defeat the enemy. And that's what our two primary heroes of the Megillah teach us.